Welcome, everybody. I'm sorry for our confusion there. We are playing around with technology, and we think we're set to go now. Welcome to this Illuminate session. I'm very pleased to present Virginia Vandal Walker today. Before we get started, I need to let you know that we are recording this session so that it can be viewed and listened to at a later date. It will be posted on the Research Center's website. And I'd also like to point out before we get going that our next session will be on February 8th when Dr. Norman Temple will be speaking to us. So before I introduce Virginia, I just want to say a few things about her background. She is an assistant professor with the Center for Nursing and Health Studies at Athabasca. She's been with Athabasca since 1995. And during that time, she has been on many committees, one of which was the Research Ethics Committee, and of which she was the chair. And she's very interested in issues dealing with research ethics and the state of the research board ethics board policy. And she's currently very involved with ALPHA on the Social Development Committee. And she's been she headed up a very successful first event just before Christmas. Virginia is involved with some research with a couple of colleagues at the University of Alberta, and that's what she's going to be reporting to us today. And without further ado, here is Virginia speaking to us about information needs of men and their partners with prostate cancer.
Hello, thank you very much, and thank you all who have joined in. I'm not sure if all of you are able to see the slides as well from your end, but one of the problems we have is that they're very dark, and the originals that I have are not this dark, but there doesn't seem to be anything we can do about them, so I apologize for that. It seems in the translation to Illuminate, it really does darken things, and I'm going to have to learn what to do so that that doesn't happen in the future. So some of what I'm going to be talking about may not be as easily visible as it should be and as it is on my computer right now. Anyway, I'm not going to be talking about prostate cancer to any great degree. I'm going to be talking about the information needs of men and their partners about prostate surgery. And I say that because that was the focus of the research that was conducted. It was specific to prostate surgery once the decision had been made that gentlemen were going to have the surgery as opposed to other treatment options. The colleagues that I worked with on this were Dr. Catherine Moore at the University of Alberta and our research assistant Diane Pine from Athabasca University. In terms of background, prostate cancer 2007, the greatest cancer threat facing Canadian men. And it's the third behind lung and colorectal cancer in cancer mortality. It affects men 50 to 79 years old. Most frequently, it will affect men, of course, younger and older, but that's the predominant age group that is affected by this. And 22,300 new Canadian cases, which is up about 1,600 from 2006 for the year 2007. Approximately 20% of these men will undergo prostate surgery, or about 2,400 a year, and 800 in Alberta will undergo prostate surgery probably within the next year. Can we do questions towards the end, or no? Go ahead. You'll probably forget what your question is. You have to talk into a mic, Norman, if you have questions.
According to that, new cancer cases went up from 1,600 to 2,230 between in 1 year from 2006.
No. They went up 1,600 from the figure that there was in 2006.
It's up
1,600. So there would have been 21,000 something, you do the math, in
7% rise.
Yeah. in 2006?
Well, 7% rise can only be an error because of diagnosis. It cannot be real. You can't have a 7% rise in 1 year. Blue or something like that, maybe.
It's not heart disease. Okay. I got these statistics from the Canadian Cancer Society, and I think it would be a good thing to follow up on that. But this is the statistics that I've received from their publication for 2007, and I actually have a copy of that. So it might be a good idea for you and I to take a look at that, and maybe we can send some questions to them.
The statistics may be real. They are the number of cases counted, and that may be true. But the point is, it's not a measure of the number of men with prostate cancer.
No, it's the number of new cases reported.
Right.
Which is, okay. All right, thank you, Norman. Anyway, other treatment options besides prostate surgery is external beam radiation therapy, interstitial radioisotope seed placement or brachytherapy, cryotherapy, and watchful waiting until the tumor gets bigger. And these are choices that can be made when the tumor is considered to be localized, and that gets determined by a biopsy. If the cancer is no longer localized, then chemotherapy is one of the options, hormone therapy to slow the cancer growth, and again, watchful waiting or no treatment at all. In terms of tumor grading, which is the way they determine the size of the tumor and what the margins look like, this tumor grading strongly influences the decisions regarding the options for treatment once diagnosis of prostate cancer is made on biopsy. It's a fundamental determinant of cancer biology and prognosis, and it is defined as a property of cancer independent of tumor location, and it's found in either biopsy or in prostatectomy specimens after surgery. Prognosis refers to the aggressive potential of a patient's prostate cancer to spread, and the Gleason score is the most important prognostic factor in determining a patient's specific risk of dying from prostate cancer. Now, most men are well aware of the blood test that they can get that can indicate perhaps change and therefore a higher risk, they would think, of prostate cancer, but it's a very unreliable test. It is still used, but it is unreliable. You can have both false positives and both false negative and false negatives from that test. Survival rates after prostate cancer, the 10-year disease-specific survival rates with radical prostatectomies are greater than 90% for low-grade adenocarcinomas, which is the term used for cancer tumors. And it's greater than 85% for medium-grade adenocarcinomas. Prostate surgery was first performed in 1904, at least that's the first recorded prostate surgery. Radical retropubic prostate surgery, referred to as RRP, is a common treatment for early stages of prostate cancer. It can be open, the traditional form, or laparoscopically performed, the LRP. And laparoscopic is the sort of the new wave of treatment where less of the skin needs to be incised, and they do it using a laparoscope, and I will go into the differences in terms of outcomes for each. Soon, robotic laparoscopic prostatectomies will be performed in Canada, and right here in Edmonton is where we will start that procedure. It's now in the research stages. One of the physicians is being trained or has just completed training in how to do robotic prostatectomies. The robotic prostatectomy uses a Da Vinci robotic slave interface, and this was developed by the military actually to use in the field, where they would have individuals out in the field, and they would have this robot, and they would be able to do surgery, not specific to prostate surgery. It provides unprecedented laparoscopic vision, and precise robotic instrument manipulation. The advantages of the radical retropubic prostatectomy is that specialized equipment and training are not required, other than the training that one has as a urological surgeon. More urologists are experienced in this surgery, because that's something that surgeons do. It's available in all major Canadian centers. In terms of the LRP advantage, the non-robotic, just the laparoscopic, you have what happens in this procedure, the lower abdomen is insufflated, which means they put air into the lower abdomen, and so you have this big gaseous abdomen, and it that gas pressure acts like an invisible hand to suppress blood loss, and it also pushes the bowel away from the surgical target site, or helps do that. This gas is exhaled after surgery. However, many people who do have LRPs complain of great gas pain problem following surgery. So they don't have postoperative incisional pain because the laparoscope is inserted into the abdomen through 4 to 5, maybe 6 small Band-Aid length incisions, or they're not Band-Aid length. The incision is covered with a Band-Aid afterward. You don't have incisional pain, but you can have gas pain significantly in the first 24 hours. Decreased operative blood loss occurs and transfusion requirements are less. Shortened hospital stays and convalescent periods. Now, this is generally only by a day or two from the traditional open prostatectomy. It may reduce treatment-related morbidity, such as incontinence and erectile dysfunction, but there is insufficient evidence to support this. That was one of the big reasons for putting a lot of money into this laparoscopic procedure, because they thought, well, we'll be able to do a much finer piece of surgery. We'll have better visualization because we have a scope close to the vessels, as opposed to just the human eye a distance away. And therefore, maybe we will have better outcomes in terms of problems with erectile function and incontinence. However, that has not proved to be. It's about the same. The statistics show that the problems are still about the same. Now, with the robotic LRP advantages, and as I say, no one in Canada is as yet performing these other than perhaps starting to here in Edmonton. I haven't been in touch since Christmas to see if they've started to do a few, but Western had a robot that was donated, but nobody to perform the surgery with the robot. And Edmonton is one of the leading areas for laparoscopic as well as robotic surgery. In many centers, Toronto, basically I'm thinking of Toronto in Saskatchewan, like Winnipeg and Saskatoon, they don't do LRPs because no one is trained to do the LRPs in those places. So in terms of the advantages of the robotic LRP, it's as per the traditional LRP, because you're doing the procedure laparoscopically, but additionally, there's better visibility than with the LRP. With the robot, the surgeons get even closer, and their hand movements translate exactly as they do outside of the body. And so it's not counterintuitive or backwards the way it is in LRP. So learning to do an LRP is much more difficult than learning to do a robotic LRP. So it reduces surgeon fatigue during the procedure, and it's easier and quicker to learn. As a result, but these robots cost a small fortune, to say the least. As a result, lower blood loss, since tiny bleeders are visible for cauterization. This increases the clarity of the vision. If you don't have a lot of blood loss, a lot of pooling of blood in the operative site, you can see better. And if you can see better, maybe you can see the margins of the prostate better. The urethra and the nerves and blood vessels for potency may be better spared as opposed to injured in the surgery. So the research study that I undertook with my colleagues was to explore the experiences of men and their partners with prostate surgery, focusing on their information needs, and to revise the prostatectomy booklet that was previously published by the Canadian Incontinence Society, or Canadian Continence Society, sorry, by Moore and Vandal Walker in 2000 and 2001. And it was based on evidence from the findings of this study that I was going to do the edits to that booklet for publication. In terms of theoretical underpinnings, the theory of uncertainty and illness by Michelle was chosen as a theoretical basis for this study. This is a common sense theory that, you know, it's not anything new to people, but uncertainty and illness is defined as a cognitive state resulting from insufficient cues with which to form a cognitive schema or meaning of a situation or event. Managing uncertainty is critical to adapting to illness, and knowledge and information are the primary resources for managing and reducing uncertainty. Research methods for revision were informed also by expert patient movement and the lay professional expert debates. And what I mean there is that traditionally in healthcare, learning materials provided to patients and their families are research based in terms of content that is told to family members about procedures and what have you, but has never been research, in general, is not research based in terms of what family members and patients have determined was really helpful to them in knowing about something. So this was, this is kind of unique in the field of patient teaching research that patients were involved in the development of the booklet. In terms of methods and procedures, of course, I conducted a systematic lit review. We had ethics board approval and from both the Athabasca University and the U of A, and informed consent from our participants. Content analysis of focus group data and written feedback, because some men couldn't attend focus groups, but they sent feedback through the email. Content expert review of the booklet once it was revised, and that was from physicians as well as nursing personnel. Content analysis of focus group data and written feedback, and content expert review of the revised booklet. So we went back to the focus group participants and asked them to take a look at it again. This is what we came up with based on what they told us, and was this reflecting what they thought would be a useful tool for them. Now this was not just about content as well. It was the way it was laid out, the format, what kind of font. There was more to it than just the actual medical and nursing content. Then the final piece of the study was a qualitative analysis of all the focus group data. And this wasn't originally considered as a purpose of this study, but there was so much data that we received from participants that didn't just fit into the book. It was more about the experience. And so that data was also analyzed. In terms of the content analysis of all focus group data and the written data feedback from men and health professionals, we just looked at all the information that was provided to us and determined how to best fit it into the book. And it informed the topics included, the points included, presentation, and format for the revised booklet. And this was an iterative process. We went back and forth with this until we came up with what we thought was the final document, but there's still some edits to do. In terms of the interpretive description, an interpretive description has been written of by Sally Thorne. Again, we used the focus group data and the written feedback from men to determine themes illustrative of their information needs. In terms of data collection, we used research literature and other teaching resources put out by other groups and other hospitals, notes from the prostate cancer support group meeting where we recruited participants, notes from the three focus groups held over 3 weeks, written feedback from the participants, revised booklet reviewed by the urologist and the urology nurse, and edited, and then the final group meeting to review the edited material. In terms of findings, just to let you know about our participants, we had 18 individuals, 13 men, and 5 partners. 2/3 of the men had had an LRP. Of course, none had had a robotic, and that left the others as having had the open form of radical prostatectomy. 6 were involved in the final review, 5 men and 1 partner, and an additional 6 provided written feedback. 2 had had surgery out of the region, and they were very informative about practices elsewhere, and 2 had had surgery between the first and second meeting, and this was interesting. In our inclusion criteria, of course, we said we wanted men who'd had prostate surgery, but we found out at our focus groups when we were introducing each other that 2 of the men had not indeed had prostate surgery. They were just so desperate for information to make an informed decision that they came to the focus group to get information, and needless to say, we did not ask them to leave. And their perceptions really did inform the interpretive analysis component of the study. And both have had surgery since, and interestingly enough, I went to a party at Christmas and bumped into one of them there, and he said I could mention that that had happened, and we were able to follow up on his surgery. And actually, he was having problems. His surgery had resulted in some other vessels being nicked that shouldn't have been, and he had just gone back in for an additional surgery. And this was an incredibly articulate individual who probably provided us with some of the best data, but some powerful data that was used in our study. And one of them being how important it is for professionals to be available, mainly psychologists, for people to talk about what they're feeling and what they're going through early on, not way back at the end when you've dealt with so much of it yourself anyway. In terms of the content analysis, there were 5 phases, and this is reflected in the book, following diagnosis until the decision was made about treatment, at home waiting for surgery, admission and surgery, in hospital post-surgery, at home post-surgery. The very first one, following diagnosis, is not reflected in the booklet, because the booklet is for gentlemen once they've determined that this is what the option they want to use for treatment. The booklet as it was produced previously looks, as you see in the next slide, looks as you see here. I'm not sure if that's what it's going to look like the next time, but that's how it is now. And in terms of the topics covered, this makes it louder. There we go. Okay, I'm not sure where we lost people, but I will be going over the 7 themes individually, so it will be repeated there. The first theme, integrated multidisciplinary information, was most beneficial and desirable as shopping for information was overwhelming, time-consuming, and with uncertain results. People wanted information about all the treatment options, and if you're told about your cancer from a surgeon, you're going to be told about the surgical options. If you happen to find out about it from an oncologist, you're going to be told about radiologic options. Getting it all in one place was problematic, and very problematic in Edmonton. This is not the same case in Calgary. Calgary has kind of a one-stop shopping unit that you can go to where you get to visit each of the different specialists to find out what each of these options might do for you so that you can make an informed decision. This multidisciplinary integrated information delivery that the men recommended included easier access to prostate cancer specialists without having to make individualized appointments over days and weeks. They wanted access to nurses who they found very helpful in interpreting a lot of what they heard, mental health professionals, pharmacists, and physiotherapists. Physiotherapists, because many men will practice pelvic floor muscle exercises in preparation for surgery, and learning how to do them correctly is not necessarily an easy thing, and physiotherapists have been used a lot to teach men this skill. They wanted one-on-one discussion with these individuals, and they wanted a discussion about the surgical information materials with the nurse. So they didn't just want to be handed a booklet. They wanted someone to talk about what's in the booklet with them. In terms of reliable and timely information to reduce uncertainty, to inform decisions about treatment options, for coping, planning, and recovery, they kept calling it the flight plan. Information sources were everywhere, but which ones are reliable? They really preferred Canadian resources because they all are, the gentlemen involved in our study were aware that, you know, a lot of the American sources, they were plugging their own treatment option because it's a money-making venture down there. They wanted it to clarify terminology about newer, more cutting-edge treatment because they'd hear about it, but they'd want to get information about this robotic surgery. Should they pay to go to the States to have it? Is it that much better? They wanted to match their information with the disease continuum. So they needed certain information at one time, other information at another time, and what they found is they often got all of it once or none of it ever, or a little bit of it at various points in time that weren't helpful for what trajectory they were in at the moment in their disease. It meant receiving the surgical information materials from the urologist, not just from the pre-admission clinic nurses. As is the case right now in many centers, the first time you would get the booklet would be when you were admitted to the hospital or just before admission to the hospital. And so a lot of the information you might have wanted to know that you could have used while waiting for surgery was you were getting it a little too late. So they felt that why doesn't the urologist give them the booklet as soon as the decision is made that that's the way they're going to go or as they are trying to make their decision. They wanted frank and honest information about the relational and psychological aspects. They felt that this often wasn't spoken of by many urologists, and this ended up often being of most significant concern about the reality of the pain, incontinence, and erectile dysfunction, because there's a lot of stories out there, what's true, what isn't true. There's statistics. Where do I sit on the statistical spectrum? Well, nobody knows. If I have to make this decision, I really do need to know as much as possible. They wanted a balanced presentation of the negative and the positive. They didn't want it, okay, you're probably not ever going to be able to have an erection, as opposed to don't worry, in 2 months you'll get erections. Like they just felt it needed to be more realistic and reflect the actual occurrences out there. They wanted information about treatment options for erectile dysfunction and incontinence. This is often, most often, never spoken of, in that there are treatments that can be engaged in to deal with the erectile dysfunction if it does occur, or because it's not all or nothing necessarily. Sometimes there can just be some erectile dysfunction. And some research is showing that if you get into some of these therapies earlier rather than later, there's a better outcome overall. Information for emotional support from professionals such as psychology, urology, family practice, and they wanted this, of course, one-on-one. They wanted to normalize the need for emotional support as opposed to those men who were comfortable asking to see a psychologist being the only ones who get it. And when you have this one-stop shopping idea, you're just plugged in to see a psychologist right off the bat, and maybe you can explore at that opportunity without looking like you're someone who's needy, as some of the men feel they look when they want to talk to someone about their concerns. They want to explore, who am I as a man? Am I cured? Am I going to survive? Can I still earn a living? I felt good before the surgery, so why don't I feel well now? These are just some of the things the gentleman brought up in the focus groups. Information about healthy living. This was really underlined both in the literature and by the men, that had they known how important being healthy was to their prognosis, they would have started running or doing whatever they could do to be as fit as possible before surgery, because it is one of the big factors in terms of how well you come through the surgery, how healthy you are going into it. And some men are able to affect a change in their health. Some people who go into the surgery with other diagnoses, well, there may not be a lot they can do, but certainly things about diet, physical activity, and sexual activity prior to going into surgery can influence your outcomes. Things such as attitudes, as well as the activities and exercise and nutrition, weight reduction, and of course tobacco cessation. In terms of their positive attitudes and positive self-talk, I'm going to win, I'm in charge, what resources do I need to get through this? Engaging in social activities and hobbies was important. Having a feeling of taking control to prevent them feeling like a victim. And one of the things they all said, take a holiday with your partner before your surgery, if you can. Sharing stories, and this is where the prostate support group comes in. It engenders support and it helps provide incredible information. And it's good for the teller as well as the listener. And this is good along the whole trajectory of the disease continuum. So there are men in this prostate support group who've been there for 10 years, and they continue to go to the groups to learn more, to present their side of the situation, and to be social support for the gentlemen going in who are newly diagnosed. As I mentioned, this is promoted through the prostate support group network, and this network is in every large city in Canada, but often people don't know that it exists unless they're told about it. It really helps these newly diagnosed men to normalize their experience. They're in a group of men that they can talk comfortably with. Most new men going to the group don't open their mouths, but when they hear these other guys talking very openly about their problems or their surgery, then they tend to join in too. And these support networks are for men as well as their partners. One of the things about sharing stories is that often the men find out about these support groups on their own. No professional tells them about this early on in their disease trajectory, and they feel that this is important information they need to know as soon as possible. Information for partners, same themes overall as for men, but additionally they need to know that the support group network is good for their access as well. They can learn coping tips, learning how to vent, because so often the partners that were in my study mentioned how they don't want to lose it, they don't want to not be strong for their partner's sake, and they need a place to go to lose it if they need to. They also would like access to people like psychologists and nurses just to talk about what they're going through. To allay anxiety during surgery, many found that whole surgical wait very difficult, of course. To mitigate discharge anxiety, often the women weren't prepared for the men to be discharged as quickly as they were, and thinking they're going to have to deal with catheters and urine for some women was a very intimidating and overwhelming experience, and they refused to take their husbands home. So, you know, just knowing what they're up against can really help that. And knowing about the erectile dysfunction, incontinence, and the emotional lability of the men. Men cry a lot during this process of the trajectory out of fear, out of various things. Certainly there can be hormonal imbalance as well that influences it, and it's strange for the men to feel this way. They don't feel manly being this way. So it's a whole pot of emotions that needs to be explored. In terms of the discussion for the research, previously unreported in the literature is the importance of one-to-one discussion with the nurse, which is quite amazing. I mean, it's common sense. One-to-one would be better than just being handed a booklet. However, it hasn't been reported that we could find. And having the teaching materials long before surgery as opposed to being given them. It's traditional when you go in for surgery that you get a whole wad of information at the pre-admission clinic. And it's overwhelming for a lot of people. Receiving the booklet from the surgeon at the time of the decision about surgery, and information about healthy living as early as possible as a way to have some control and improve outcomes. Not just as a way, it's in the literature that being as healthy as possible is good, but providing information about that to potential surgical patients is not reported in the literature. And information for emotional support in terms of easier access to psychologists. So most of the traditional surgical information deals with this is what's going to happen with your surgery. This is, you know, what you're going to need for dressings, and this is going to be some of the side effects. And many of these more touchy-feely sort of points are not dealt with. All the other themes have been reported in one way or another and supported in the literature. Certainly discussions about planning of this one-stop shopping is occurring. Even here in Edmonton, there is a movement afoot. Many of the urologists have moved to one building, and they're looking at Capital Health is looking at trying to institute a more comprehensive multidisciplinary approach, but we're new at starting that here. This approach results in some significant increase in both patient and staff satisfaction, and in decreased wait times for services. Territoriality and lack of understanding of roles of team members are barriers to this occurring. Studies support the approach taken to conduct this study in terms of using focus groups of patients and the findings of integrated information delivery and reliable and timely information. Information for partners and sharing stories, as well as frank and honest information about incontinence and erectile dysfunction, are also supported in the literature, as are information for emotional support and sharing, and information about healthy living in terms of the benefit healthy living has, as opposed to the fact that providing that information early can give the patients a feeling of control over their destiny a little bit. In terms of limitations of the study, participants were self-selected. They all came from similar socioeconomic English-speaking backgrounds, although I was prepared to conduct interviews in French as well, because I am French-speaking, but we had no French-speaking participants. It is not necessarily reflective of experiences of men and their partners from other Canadian centres. It may be, it may not be. And no rural or small town participants, although I was hoping that we would have participants from rural or small town. We were prepared to go to those locales to do interviews if at all possible. But it generally was through the prostate cancer support group that word of mouth went out for participants. And once people go back to their hometowns, wherever they are, you lose contact with them. And I think that is I think their perspective would be a very important perspective, as are the perspectives of individuals who aren't out information seeking the way these gentlemen were. This was a group of men, most of whom had very good educations, and so are they a type that wants this kind of information? And we have another type that just get it over with, do it, and, you know, we won't talk about it after that. I just sort of had a discussion like that with one of the urologists, because I really wonder what the needs are of those gentlemen, but maybe that's it. Maybe they just, it's behind them, move on from there. You do what you have to do. It's a more stoic, perhaps, way of looking at it, a less need to control. I don't know. I mean, it's all moot at this point. In terms of implications, the revised booklet has been completed in both French and English and submitted for publication pursuant to dissemination in print and online. It's been submitted to AU Press, and they've just received external reviews back, and we'll be meeting next week, and I should hear next week what the results are. So I'm quite anxious to hear what's going to go on. This booklet is evidence-based. Following diagnosis, information from health professionals should be integrated. We need to reassess the practice of providing informational materials at admission and even later by surgical unit nurses. And written materials are not enough for the delivery of information. Discussion is needed with the nurse too. Supports encouraging more open discussion and referrals to other health professionals. In terms of conclusion, the diagnosis of prostate cancer triggers uncertainty for men and their spouses about survival. For men, uncertainty about one's manhood and how the diagnosis and treatment chosen will change one's intimate relationships and quality of life. Study results indicated that an integrated multidisciplinary approach is needed to meet both partner and patient information needs about such topics as terminology, prognosis, emotional support, treatment options for decision making, prostate surgery, incontinence, and impotence. Without social support, including professional support from health professionals throughout the provision of information, uncertainty is not ameliorated, but rather is augmented. And for my final slide, I have a quote from a gentleman who said I could, not only did he say I could use his name, he was honored when I asked if I could. He says, you know, I've provided information to so many researchers and nobody ever wanted to know who I really was. And I'm proud of who I am and what I have to say. And I thought that was great. Anyway, this is Arnie. He happens to be the president of the prostate support group here in Edmonton. He's got quite a story to tell in terms of his journey with prostate cancer. He's still cancer free, but did have difficulties during his surgery and had to go for additional treatments after surgery. What he had to say was a positive attitude, information seeking, the will to prevail, sound and timely professional help and information, and the faith and love of family are needed to successfully come through this and deal with what the future holds. Your partner's involvement in discussions pre, during, and post-surgery is paramount. Two sets of ears are better than one, because you hear an awful lot and it's so easy to forget. One of the other things that isn't really reflected here is that all the participants who came with their partners indicated that the experience that they had with prostate surgery brought them closer to their spouses, because many of them had not had really close relationships in terms of talking about fears and these sorts of things beforehand. And so this is that silver lining to every cloud. The barriers were removed and they became very close. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention. I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was very, very.
I was thinking of my men.
Somebody said they raised a hand online, but I don't see any hands raised.
Are there any questions? If you want to go back to however you do that, I was just telling them on. illuminate to go ahead and...
I'm not sure that I can do it, but if you want to raise your hand and speak to us, I will try to acknowledge you and give you the mic. If you just would rather send a question printed on the whiteboard here, we'll answer it that way too. Is the sound on again? No.
Oh, the sound is gone. Oh, no, it's there.
No, it's here.
This is Jeff Taylor. I take it all of the men were heterosexual.
Yes, and that's an interesting point because, of course, when I first went into this, I was calling it partners and spouse, and I see I missed it a couple of times in my presentation. Men and their partners is the better terminology to use, but all of them were heterosexual. But I think as time goes on, of course, we're going to see people, I don't know if they would show up at prostate support groups. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, there's no reason why they wouldn't unless there was concerns about homophobia or something. But
well, I think there might be.
Yeah. But, I mean, that would be an interesting variable in terms of attitudes towards masculinity and, you know, the effect on... I'm not suggesting it would go either, which way it would go, and I'm sure it would be mixed between heterosexual and gay, but I think that would be an interesting dynamic. Is there anything in the literature around that?
I didn't look specifically for it, so I can't say definitively one way or the other. Certainly never jumped out when I was doing a lit review, but I wasn't looking specifically under that terminology, and I might have found something, and I'm sort of prompted to go back now, and I'll look, and I'll see what I can find. It would be a great study. It really would.
Yeah, and the other issue, which you touched on a bit in your presentation, when you talked about the rural or urban and the more educated, I mean, is the class dynamic that, I mean, it sounds as if these are professional class, middle class participants who, again, there's different masculinities depending on class and urban, rural, and so forth. And I mean, you did touch on some of those issues. You're attentive to those, but again, that would be an interesting dynamic as well.
Yes, I really feel, of course, because we're looking now. This booklet has a huge readership. I think I can't recall specifically. I think it's around 6,000 booklets were published the first go round back in 1999-2000, and they were all used. They were all taken and used, and they've been requesting more. So there's a wide readership for it. But I'm just wondering if it's only given in pre-admission clinic, and I really would love to be able to just be recruiting men who don't show up at prostate support group. Some of them didn't. There were some men who I had by word of mouth who didn't go to the prostate support group, but the majority did come from there. Because not everybody is a groupie, so to speak. That's what they call themselves, the groupies, the ones who like to talk about it.
Yes, Virginia, this is very good. But there's still a lot more I have to learn, but I wanted to go back to the first slide where you started, where the incidence you said I think it was the highest incidence of cancer for
men.
Men?
Yeah, the greatest cancer threat facing men.
Okay, and it's just an interesting to compare it with the breast cancer for women. You know, they have Run for the Cure. This is celebrated in the press. It's all over the place. At one time, this was a bit silent. It was in the closet, and women took it out of the closet and put it on the main street. What do you think are some of the barriers in terms of action? Because women had to overcome those barriers. Is it this whole thing of masculinity? The men are afraid about this? Because I haven't seen a prominent person come out and say, "Look, we have to do something about it. I had it. Somebody else I know had it," and they say it loud. And it brings other people out. I mean, is there any sign that this is going to come out of the closet, if I could put it that way, so that it gets the public recognition that it deserves?
It's a new matriarchy.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, interesting that way.
I think you touch on many of the points that people think is the reason why. Certainly, it's not a sexy disease. Like, heart disease is a sexy disease. When men get heart disease, they tell people about it, and there's loads of money for heart disease. Now, there's a fair amount of money there for prostate cancer research, but there isn't anybody wanting to stand up to say, I had prostate surgery and I'm impotent. Because, or I had prostate surgery and maybe people will think they are impotent.
Yeah.
Because that could have occurred. Mm-hmm. And there is a degree of impotency that can occur for many men, but not all men. And are you a better candidate standing up saying, I had surgery, I'm not impotent?
Yeah.
Like, it's that whole piece about impotent that I think is
right.
Very
and for women, I've lost a breast. I'm no longer a woman, so that they had to a certain extent overcome that. I mean, wasn't that sign? That was a part of it, wasn't it?
Right.
I'm no longer full. I'm no longer complete.
I just wanted to draw everybody's attention to the screen. Dale has sent us a message, and I'm going to try and give you the mic.
Can you hear me now?
It works.
I think you can hear me. Anyway, a friend of mine. Just this past year organized a run for prostate cancer, and it actually had large corporate sponsorship, large participation, and it raised quite a bit of funding. I think it was Jay that asked the question. I could give the name. The person that organized it was Kevin Fitzgerald, and he's a manager with Wells Fargo. But anyway, it was quite well received.
On. I went to one of the prostate support group meetings, and they were talking about this big run they were going to have where they run through the city. But I think a lot of people, if it hasn't touched them, if it hasn't affected them, they don't really, these things are invisible to them even if they're out there.
A few years ago, my husband took part in a triathlon that was in aid of such a thing, and they gave away these horrible looking t-shirts, bright yellow with this Neanderthal looking guy on the front of it.
I think as more of the boomers get to this stage, you're going to see more interest, perhaps more openness.
And one of the reasons that that women are running for the cure, making public, is to have more research.
Yes.
and to get into the elements of causation and prevention. And I wasn't sure just in terms of this particular cancer of causes. Often people think it was me, something I did, something I ate, I could have done something about it. And then we're also recognizing that there are environmental causes, and you know we live in a very toxic society in terms of what we're exposed to. So could you kind of speak to the element of causation is there as well?
I think the research is very minimal that has been done in terms of prostate cancers compared to others. Statistics indicate that more and more men under 50 are showing up with prostate cancer, so they think there is an environmental toxic reason behind those cancers. But they have really not conducted a lot of definitive research that allows me to be able to say that. One of the questions I've asked about use it or lose it, I'm sure you've all heard that one, and that seems to have no bearing from research that exists so far, other than use it or lose it can be important just before surgery, like shortly before surgery. Like, am I getting myself clear here? As long as, you're not a don't use it for 10 years prior to going into surgery. If, let's say you didn't use it for the first 30 years of your life, which probably isn't going to happen, but anyway, no it isn't, so I don't even know why I'm going there. Just that I know as a wife, I wanted to know if I have a role to play in helping prevent problems, and I only have a role to play maybe to help prevent post-surgical problems, okay, not to prevent prostate cancer.
Okay. I'm to the rescue. We have a question online. I'm going to try and give the mic to Chuck.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I want to comment on the earliest someone I can remember was Jay or somebody point out the lack of awareness of this kind of cancer. I think it since a number of politicians or well-known people have disclosed the fact that they had prostate cancer, people such as Nelson Mandela, Pierre Trudeau, Alan Rock, and what is his name, Juliana, the New York mayor, to the former New York mayor. And I think it that make people, I think, more aware of the prevalence of prostate cancer. Another point I want to respond is to Norman's earlier question about the number of new cases. I think it has to do with perhaps the new tests that have come on in the last, I don't know, a number of years, the PSA test. Before that, it was not as common. And what else? Yeah, I forgot what else I wanted to talk about, but essentially I did a little bit, quite a bit of research a number of years ago, also looking into the different possible causes. So I read quite a bit on that, and there has been some research that suggests that people of certain ethnic groups, for example, they are African background, and people read a lot of red meat, smoking, and then there are a number of things that a diet have been suggested as the possible causes, but there's nothing really definitive. I think the literature is very mixed. And what I also found out was also there is a lot of variations in how aggressive this type of cancer is. Some people, actually a lot of people die with it, like older people over 80 years old, they died with the cancer because, they die of something else, a heart disease or some other things. But on the hand, of course, there are people who are stuck with a very aggressive kind of cancer. And you may wonder why I'm talking about these, why I did so much research or some research on that. It was more of a personal, the fact that my husband has a prostate cancer. So I'm trying to keep a little bit up to date on that.
Thank you, Chuck. Yes, the red meat smoking diet, which are implicated in it, just about everything, but again, it's not definitive. The people for whom watch and wait is often the treatment chosen as well as recommended tend to be your gentlemen in the older age group because they have slower growing cancers. When you get cancer at a younger age, chances are it may be the more faster growing cancer and they choose to be more aggressive. There are many people who die and they find out if an autopsy is performed that they have prostate cancer, but the individuals never died of prostate cancer. They died of other causes, as Chuck mentioned. The other thing is the PSA test, which most men get on a regular basis now, which I mentioned at the outset is not definitive. There's false negatives, false positives with that test. Nonetheless, it is being conducted routinely by physicians and has increased the numbers that we are seeing who become diagnosed with prostate cancer. Now, you are not diagnosed as a result of the PSA test. You need to have biopsies if you have an elevated over a period of time and there's indication as a result of a manual examination as well that you may very well have prostate cancer, then they would do the biopsy. And even doing biopsies, you can miss cancer because biopsies take samples from around the the whole prostate, and you can miss it. So you may have to have repeated biopsies if you end up having symptoms that may be indicative of that. And certainly the symptoms of prostate enlargement are also the symptoms that could be there of prostate cancer. I mean, if you've got cancer, usually almost all of the time, I think, you have prostate enlargement, which causes those other problems like getting up at night. You shouldn't be getting up at night to void. If you do, you probably have enlargement. You shouldn't have trouble maintaining a stream. You should be able to, if you have to start and stop or think about it a long time before you start, unless you're a man who traditionally did that. And there are men who need quiet and focusing until they can get a stream initiated. I know a lot about the different streams, but anyway. Okay, I won't go there, but anyway. Yeah, I guess that's all I had to say. Thanks, Chuck. Yes, please.
Hi, Virginia. I'm sorry I'm late. My name's Jeff Balance. I work with Virginia. I hope you have a lot of time on your hands coming up, because you've given me about two or three ideas for grants that you and I need to put together that stems from the work that you've done here. I'll try not to babble here. As you know, I work in the breast cancer population, and specifically looking at the effects of physical activity post-treatment, so in breast cancer survivors. In the breast cancer group right now, in terms of physical activity, we have about 60 or 70 studies. Many of those gold standard randomized control trials showing very, very positive, exciting outcomes. You mentioned a lot of terms in your presentation, such as psychosocial distress, anxiety, coping. In many of those breast cancer studies, we're showing very positive changes, clinically meaningful changes in those outcomes in the breast group. But in the prostate group, I can probably count on my one hand how many studies we have in physical activity. The best, well, not the best study, but probably the most gold standard study was actually done at the U of A in conjunction with Ottawa. They looked at a program focusing on resistance training with men going through androgen deprivation therapy, showed clinically meaningful changes in quality of life. Quality of life always seems to be the number one outcome that we look at. So, you know, just to touch on this gentleman's point a few minutes ago, is breast cancer more sexy than prostate cancer? How can we have, you know, 60 plus studies in breast cancer, but maybe 5 or 6 studies in prostate cancer? There's clearly a demand for health information, and we know there's a demand in other tumor groups as well, particularly in the breast. There's a demand for these types of things, but why are we not seeing it in this group? I mean, you and I are going to do about 2 or 3 grants coming up, so.
Okay. Right on. You know, I can't answer that. I don't know. I just do know that men, until they become affected by this disease, have blinders on, choose to have blinders on, don't want to deal with it. And that's a generalization that I probably shouldn't be making without data to confirm it. I only have the data that there aren't the studies out there, and there's big money. CIHR has money for prostate cancer research, and I don't know, and I don't think that they're having a lot of people. I mean, we're getting people putting in funding for, okay, I want to test my robotic surgical procedure, but we're not looking at more than just those surgical and radiologic sorts of treatment studies, and we need so much more than that. Even a study as to why aren't more people interested in discussing it.
But isn't that a general question across all cancers? That is, that the emphasis on breast cancer kind of crowds out, sucks up all oxygen in terms of studies across the board. I mean, how much work, for example, is done on pancreatic cancer and other cancers? They all seem to be submerged on this one, and I'm not denying the place of the one, but it seems to be across the board that so much focus is spotlights here, and all the others on the perimeters in semi-darkness. So
well,
it's just not prostrate,
no,
it's
it
in general.
But when you look at it being the number one, that, you know, I think, whereas if you look at, you just mentioned pancreatic, it's not as prevalent. Yes, it's prevalent. I think what we have is a bit of a knee-jerk pendulum kind of reaction. the breast cancer research didn't have a lot of research for a long time, didn't have a lot of funding, and it was brought out in the media as being a male anti-female kind of a thing, and women need to have their diseases looked at now. The men had their sexy heart diseases looked at, and it was male heart disease we looked at. We didn't look at female heart disease initially.
I mean, as a political scientist, I see a political power element there in terms of how it's emerges in terms of public interest.
Right, and so I think we got, because of the hue and cry, we've gotten funding there. I mean, everybody's mother could, you know, we used a lot of those kinds of points to get public support as well as government support. But what you've got now is the pendulum coming back, and I think we need to be looking at other areas needing to be looked at. And I think we have some gender reasons why it isn't up on the forefront. Until our alpha males were coming down with heart disease, we didn't have a lot of funding for heart disease. We need a lot more alpha males than have already got prostate cancer to get it and, you know, bring the awareness out more. Because that's why there's so much money in heart disease. And you really see it as a nurse researcher. The kind of research I've done in ICUs, basically I would do my research in ICU and I would go and talk to staff to find out what their general knowledge was of the topic, and I would go to coronary care and find out what the general staff knowledge was, and their knowledge far surpassed the knowledge of the people in the ICU that were just dealing with general systems illnesses, and nothing was sexy in there about having the kinds of diseases that people do there. But you go to your, I mean, we've got a whole new hospital, for heaven's sakes, just for cardiac. And it's state of the art. Money's coming from our alpha males.
go ahead, Norma.
I'm really getting opinionated here. I should watch it.
Well, I'll give an opinion as well. There hasn't actually been one single study ever done yet which has demonstrated that treatment for prostate cancer adds as much as one single day onto the life of any man. Not one single study. There's a lot of...
But that would take a random controlled trial. We can't.
That would take a randomly controlled trial, which you can do, because...
You can't deny treatment.
Yes, you can deny treatment. Ethically, under the Tri Council policy, you can certainly deny treatment where there is no proven treatment available. And there is no proven treatment available because no treatment has ever been demonstrated to work for prostate cancer. No treatment for prostate cancer has ever been demonstrated to work, because it cannot be demonstrated to work in the absence of a clinical trial.
Absolutely.
All evidence to show that treatment for prostate cancer works is entirely based on supposition. Nothing more, supposition. Namely, the person's got cancer, therefore if you remove it, in theory that should be an improvement. Mm-hmm. That's not science. That's not evidence. That's supposition.
I agree that perhaps one could do a clinical... I agree with your points in terms of there has not been a random RTC devised. And one could be devised if you put people into the group who would self-select, and then it's not random. It wouldn't be random. People to self-select who chose not to have treatment. And then you've ruined the randomization already, because they're self-selecting, and so you've ruined the opportunity of
have an RCT
data
based on self-selection.
No,
that's
I know.
A contradiction in terms.
I just said that.
Yes. The problem was the screening, the testing, the early diagnosis for prostate cancer, it came out about 10 or 15 years ago. And what happened was, two things happened when you looked at the statistics from 10 or 15 years ago. Two things happened simultaneously. Number one, the incidence of prostate cancer doubled overnight. And secondly, the cure rate doubled overnight. And what the only interpretation of these numbers that makes the slightest sense is that prostate cancer is two totally different diseases, which you sort of briefly alluded to a couple of minutes ago. Namely, there is true cancer, true prostate cancer, which has existed, still exists, and probably the cure rate of it has not gone up. There's no evidence that the cure rate for real prostate cancer has gone up one iota in the last 25 years, not one iota of evidence. And there's the other type of prostate cancer, which is a totally bogus type. It doesn't exist. It's never existed. It's the sort of cancer that people die of when they drop dead of a heart disease or something else, and they find this prostate cancer in them at pathology. And that's a disease that should never have been treated in the first place. It costs money, it causes anguish, and it doesn't add one day onto the length of the life of the person. So we have this situation where vast amounts of money is being spent. Thousands and thousands of men are having all sorts of mental anguish, and we don't have a scrap of evidence that anybody is being benefited as a result of this. In the book I had that came out last year, I had one chapter on screening for cancer by an expert from Belgium who has actually published quite a few articles on screening for cancer in leading medical journals, and he wrote that screening for prostate cancer is medical malpractice. And I think there's a solid basis of evidence for this. In my estimation, I think the entire screening process, all PSA testing, all screening for prostate cancer, should be stopped immediately on the grounds it's medically unethical.
We've talked before, Norman and I, so this isn't the first time I've heard it. And this is okay. Like, I appreciate the points he has raised, and when he raised them to me a year ago, I went back to the books and did some more looking and whatnot, and, you know, just said, well, fine, I'm dealing with research once the decision is made to have the surgery. But definitely there is writing out there that says the PSA test is too fraught with problems, that we shouldn't be doing it for everyone. But there's the other side that says, ethically, people want the option to do something if they choose to do something. If you don't choose to do something, and that is why, never will you, throughout everything here, it is the choice of the man and his partner what is done. Well, it's the choice of the man. And they all want to get as much information. And if they come to the same conclusion you do, Norman, then they may choose to do nothing. Certainly if they have a biopsy done that tells them that, you know, the margins are far exceeding, most of them will opt to do something about it. They will.
Norm, just for clarification, because I'm an ignoramus here. But in terms of control groups, in terms of breast cancer, are there control groups for women who are denied breast cancer treatment versus those who go through it? I mean, I don't understand the...
No, what they have, there has never been a trial that I can think of offhand where women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer have then been randomized into two groups, given treatment or not. But what there has been is the next best thing, which is two sets of trials, about five, six trials on screening for breast cancer, which is more or less the same thing as you're referring to, more or less the same thing. There has been one or two in Sweden. There was a double one in Canada and two or three others, two in the US. There's been quite a bit of controversy over these and interpretation. I won't get into the statistics of what these trials show, but I can if people want. But basically, there has been a number of trials of this is what's needed on prostate cancer, you see. They've done trials where they take 10, 20,000 women and randomize them into two groups. One group will get nothing, and the other group will be sent for breast cancer screening, and they're followed for around 10 or 15 years. And you need to check what is the mortality rate. I can give you an hour lecture on the problems of these trials if you want, which I won't. But that.
And what was the year? What was the year they started that trial?
The breast cancer.
Yep.
they started, the results have come out over the last 10 or so years, so the trials probably started 50. So
exactly.
It must have been started about 25 years ago.
Exactly. And that was before, I mean, a blood test is so less intrusive, invasive, and easier to do than the screening techniques for breast cancer. So people look at that and they weigh the cost-benefit ratio analysis here where, okay, I'm going to get poked, I'm going to have blood taken, maybe it doesn't do anything, but maybe it does, and I'm going to find out, as opposed to you don't have to go and get, you know, book this mammogram and, you know, go through what you have to go through to get that. It's nothing like having a blood test. And so I think that it's the people's, you can't just look, I mean, when you're looking at cost benefits, you've got to look at the whole picture. The way the person thinks about science, the value they place on science, the way they look at wanting to have some control over whether they live with a tumor or not. Maybe they don't want to live with it. I mean, people are making decisions all the time just to get wrinkles removed, for heaven's sakes, let alone choosing to get a tumor removed or treated. I think you could get into some ethical discussions as to whether this should be at taxpayers' cost as opposed to not. I could see those discussions, but I think it's the science as best as we've got it for now. And that doesn't by any sense mean that it's as good as it's ever going to get.
Say that up again. What do you mean the science is as good? There is no science.
The science of doing the blood test, the PSA,
there is no science.
Is all that they've got so far.
There's no science of any value. It's just PSA is an indicator of risk of prostate cancer.
Well, why do you say it's not science?
Well, because that's only about a third of the story. That's an indicator.
That doesn't have a third of the science. It's part of the picture. And they say that you can't make a decision just based on the PSA. No one says that you do. You don't.
Excuse me. I think we're losing our online participants. Chuck, did you have did you want me to give you the mic back? Maybe you could give me a sign if you have another question or a comment. Otherwise, I think we're going to close it down. I guess we have one more question
well,
here.
Well, after Norman's comments, I have lots of comments.
We always do.
Okay.
I'll pass.
Okay. Well, maybe we can carry this on in private. Get the swords out. Thank you all very much, and we're going to sign off now. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks.